Let me talk a little bit about what I'm going to try to do today, and I think it's fair to say that I've set a relatively ambitious agenda. I thought several months ago I knew where I was going with this lecture, and in the last several weeks, due to further reading and some discussions with philosophical colleagues, I've decided to take it in a relatively new and hopefully for you novel perspective. I've set for myself two central tasks. I do think that part of what this kind of interface reaction can do is for me to be an educational agent and take you through where, summer 2011, the search for genetic risk factors for psychiatric disorders sit. So I'm going to take about the first third of my time to try to show you where things stand in that research domain. Then I want to turn really to the most serious consideration about how thinking about the way the world we conceive it to be, that is that most of us live within two worlds. One is the world of atoms bouncing around, mechanistic scientific explanations, where we understand genes as these conveyors of biological information. They make proteins, the proteins construct cells, the cells can influence organs, but that is a world that we relatively feel comfortable in, and the world of human agency and volition. How do we think about how those two relate to one another? And my central task will be, at the end of my lecture, to show you that those are considerably more intertwined than you might previously think, with the major point being that human volitional activity really can influence the expression of our own genes for key behavioral traits. So that's where I'm heading. So the two worldviews, as I discussed, atoms, mechanical bonds, and conscious agents, they seem incommensurable, yet as children of the Western Enlightenment, all of us basically live in both of these worlds. So my day job, as Richard said, was for the last 25 years, the study of the role of genetic factors in the etiology of psychiatric and drug abuse disorders. For nearly 10 years, I've tried to read in the relevant areas of philosophy, mostly philosophy of science. As I want to admit as a disclaimer up front, I have no real knowledge of the law. So I think I've showed you this already. I hope this will be relevant and of interest to you. So I want to start with our standard view of gene action. Think back to what you learned in high school. Genes make proteins, some of which are essential for our bodies and brains to function normally. If the gene has a mutation in a key area, the protein that is made from that gene is dysfunctional. That can cause disease. I want to introduce you to the key concept of penetrance. This is, given that you possess an abnormal gene, what is the probability that that manifestations of the gene will be evident, that you will display the disease? Mendelian disorders, named after the famous Austrian monk Gregor Mendel, have this lovely characteristic that makes the science very simple. If you have an abnormal gene, you will always develop the disease. No ifs, ands, or buts. That is called a penetrance of unity. You always get the illness. So let's take cystic fibrosis and the CFTR gene, and you're going to be seeing quite a lot of these little diagrams here, so I want you to begin to get used to it. This is a gene causing a disturbed physiological process that then causes a somatic disease. Simple, deterministic. We also knew that these work in the brain. So the Huntington gene, which is disturbed through a certain amount of poly-A tail put onto the gene that causes a protein that cannot be well broken down, that is toxic to cells in the basal ganglia, cause Huntington's chorea. So again, we have a very simple causal pathway. Gene, disturbed physiological process, brain disease, disturbed behavior. Satisfying picture, tidy, responsibility, blame, morality, volition, intentionality, it doesn't really enter. Again, atoms bouncing around in a void. A behavior due to a disease, few would claim moral responsibility. So my job is to mess up this tidy picture, to try to show you how intertwined genes, moral responsibility, and behavior can be. Most of my examples will focus on drug use and misuse for reasons that I think will become clear. So I want to also take you to the front lines of gene discovery, as I mentioned a moment ago. I want to show and then take you down these less trodden roads that will show you the lack of clarity that arises when we think hard and review current research about how the nature of gene action on human behavior and the role of volition and moral responsibility. So to the front lines. Recall the model we've grown up with. Genes cause behavior. The causal pathway should be short, direct, deterministic. This does work for a handful of rare examples, but for major psychiatric disorders, it does not. I'm going to start you with the results for the disorder schizophrenia, the most severe of common psychiatric disorders, and going to introduce you to what's known in my world as the PGC, the Psychiatric GWAS Consortium. What does this consortium consist of? This is now the samples developed across multiple areas in North America and Europe. I will be showing you data in a moment with a total of the first sample of 9,394 cases of schizophrenia. You can see the number of controls, 21,800 total individuals, and then a replication sample of over 30,000. This is where psychiatric genetics is now resting, trying to discover the genetic basis of psychiatric disease. I will quote you, this is a paper that was accepted in Nature Genetics 1 week ago and will appear later this month. This is right out to the front edges. This study was designed to examine the role of common genetic variation in schizophrenia based on a combined genome-wide association study, which I'll explain to you in a minute, of unprecedented size. A stage one discovery sample of 21,856 individuals of European ancestry, stage two, etc. You get the point. Now, what is a genome-wide association study? This entered into the consciousness of science in this key paper published in Nature in June of 2007. The study began with 2,000 individuals with each of seven major diseases and a common set of 3,000 controls. The results are all summarized in these, which, by the way, in my trade are called Manhattan plots. This is the human genome laid end to end. The human genome has between 3.1 and 3.3 billion base pairs. It goes from the top of chromosome 1 to the bottom of the X chromosome, a total of 22 autosomes and the sex chromosomes. The y-axis here is the logarithm of the p-value. So that's 10 to the minus 5, 10 to the minus 10, 10 to the minus 15. If you are a gene hunter, what you are seeking for is something like this. This is what would be the World Tree Towers of yesterday that rise from the background of this extremely highly significant finding, suggesting that there are genetic variants underneath this very determined peak that strongly influence the risk for rheumatoid arthritis. This is a genome-wide association study, and this paper showed for medically complex disorders that the method could work. Absolutely extraordinary. There's a great deal of skepticism initially. The poster child of this is Crohn's disease, which is an inflammatory disease of the bowel, and you see there's more than six or seven areas where you clearly see the statistical signal rising above the background of statistical noise. So this is the current method of choice for the localizing genetic variants for complex disorders. This is the result from the schizophrenia genome-wide association study I just showed you. Now, this is a complex slide. It contains lots of information. The key point is that there are many loci scattered across the genome that are touching this magical limit, which is about 10 to the minus 5 times 10 to the minus 8, the line here, that reflects the chances that that is a true finding. The major point here is that the genetics of these disorders are extraordinarily complex. You can see here that we have seven or eight genome-wide loci, a number that are touching genome-wide significance. And when we look at the effect size of each of these individual genes, their impact is very small. So you go back 25 years when the molecular genetic studies began for psychiatric disorders, we felt we may be discovering single or small numbers of genes of large effect. We fast forward 20 to 25 years later, what is clear is that we are discovering dozens and dozens and ultimately hundreds of genes, each of which individually contribute a very small amount of total risk. Let me give you a few facts just to put this in perspective. Increase of schizophrenia in the identical co-twin of a twin with schizophrenia is about 100-fold. The genes that I showed you, the most significant on this slide, even this in the HLA region, which is on chromosome 6, has a total odds ratio of about 1.1. That means if you possess that gene and the background population risk is 1%, your risk is 1.1%, a very small incremental increase. Lots of other loci appear to arise in background. This is a slide that I'm not going to talk you through if we want to talk in the discussion section. This shows you, by studying tens of thousands of loci and gathering those together in aggregate patterns of risks, and then taking those genetic scores and testing them on other samples, generating these exceptionally small p-values, that there are at least 500 to 1,000 individual loci that contribute to risk for schizophrenia. This is now widely accepted. This is the nature and the architecture of the genetic risk for these complex disorders. Okay, so what do we now know about the possible pathways from genes to behavior? Do we have the nice story of a simple mutation causing one biological function resulting in a disease? No. Instead of this very simple pattern of gene leading to disease, in fact, patterns look something like this. This is a causal pathway, all empirically done in our large-scale studies of Virginia twins, with genetic risks for major depression sitting up here, and these being a range of the key intervening steps, all of which substantially impact on risk for major depression in the last year. I'm obviously not going to take the time to walk you through this, but this is a picture of what is the legitimate complexity of what stands between genes on the one hand and disease on the other. If you want to see how the pathway from genes alone, the diverse series of effects and intermediate so-called mediational mechanisms through which genes impact on illness. Okay, so that's the first part of the talk. So the major lesson, which I don't think is going to be a surprise to you, but brings you up to date, is how complex these patterns are as our science has led us to. Now, hopefully, things will get a little bit more interesting. This is the diagram that we talked about, this little causal arrows. We go from gene to unconscious physiological processes to behavior. I now want to introduce you to a mechanism that differs in one very important way from this, which is that this phenomenon of human volition, volitional behavior, is introduced into this causal pathway. I want to show you two examples by which we can begin with a gene that itself certainly has a physiology. That physiology impacts on our behavior that involves volitional mechanisms of us choosing certain behaviors that then in turn result in increased risk for disease. The first is going to be peer group deviance. The second is going to be nicotine intake and cancer. Those of you familiar with the literature, this is known in my end of the literature as called active genotype environment correlation. So, this is a research project that I completed several years ago. The title I gave, a little bit more poetic than is typically seen, The Creation of Our Social World Through Development. I measured a phenotype called peer group deviance in a series of 750 male-male twin pairs born in Virginia and studied as part of our longitudinal cohort. What is peer group deviance? For several ages, we asked these twins to enumerate who their friends were, and then ask them how many, what proportion of those friends did things like smoked cigarettes, used alcohol, got drunk frequently, had other problems with alcohol, skipped school, committed crimes, sold drugs to other children, or in physical fights, etc. So high scores represent young-to-be juvenile delinquents. Low scores represent choir boys who basically went to church, studied, were very well behaved. We assessed five ages from childhood up through early adulthood. I think it's always a good idea to give people a little sense about what the data is like, so we just grabbed a series of individuals from our sample to show you the trajectories of their peer group deviancy from those in late elementary school to early adulthood. So we have a person like A, who already in elementary school was hanging around with relatively rough kids, and he continues that trajectory. So the time that in his early 20s, he's hanging around with a quite rough crowd. Contrast that to individual G, who was really hanging around with a very well-behaved group of peers when he was in elementary school, and he gets on this trajectory that's headed for no good, as over time his peers become more and more deviant. There was quite a lot of amusement in our research group at the trajectory of individual E, who looks like he was doing fairly well in high school, and then aims of looking like he's really headed for trouble in early adulthood. The sense was that he probably met a really good Christian woman who kept him staying at home completely out of trouble by the time he was in early adulthood. So he wasn't going anywhere at this point. This shows you the rich diversity and variance that we see. And in fact, we know empirically that the differences increased over time. Now, the question from my research perspective is why? What causes individuals to select themselves into certain kinds of peers? Peers who are college-bound, peers who tend to value the values of their parents and their school, want to succeed in discipline, versus peers that reject the kind of parental authority, who think that getting into a fight on a Saturday night after drinking is really a fine thing. And that's the way to show that you're really a good man and you don't listen to your parents, because that's the value, that kind of rebellious approach. This summarizes a lot of information. This is a curve of the sources of individual differences across ages in peer group deviance. The key thing I want to point you towards is this yellow line, which reflects the increasing influence of genetic effects. And what this shows, without taking you through all the statistical details, is that as people age, they become more different in their choices of social friends, and that much of what is driving that difference is genes. That the pattern is genetic influences on temperament. Temperament causes you to self-select into certain peer groups, and those peer groups in turn have very important feedback on your risk for subsequent psychopathology, especially in the area of criminal behavior and drug use. So that is an example now in which my genetic factors are causing a certain personality and causing me to like to hang around with certain groups of individuals, and that choice and decision has important impact on my risk for psychiatric illness. Let me give you an even more overt example of that same kind of process. In the last 4 years, we've made major advances into studying risk genes for nicotine dependence. Some of that research has been done here in Virginia. A consistent series of findings show that we have a strong link to the risk for nicotine dependence on a tight block of nicotine receptor genes on the short arm of chromosome 15. When you smoke a cigarette, that nicotine is rapidly absorbed in your bloodstream, travels into your brain, and directly binds with receptors on cells that bind directly to nicotine. So it is no surprise that potential variance in how avidly that nicotine binds to receptors might impact on your risk for nicotine dependence. I don't expect you to follow this slide. This is the kind of world that I live in. This is a LD plot of showing the association in this particular area in 15q, and these are the key genes involved: nicotine alpha-3, beta-4, and alpha-5 receptor. I also decided to show you, just to see, this is now meta-analyses of the impact of variants in those nicotinic receptors on the number of smoking cigarettes per day. If you're not impressed with the consistency of these findings, you should be. In behavioral genetics, it is exceptionally rare to find so many studies that strongly agree that variants in this gene impact on your risk for nicotine dependence. This is not so surprising. The following is much more surprising. This is now the risk from a smaller number of studies of lung cancer. So I want you to think for a minute about what might be going on. How is it that a variant in nicotine receptors expressed in your brain impacts on your risk for lung cancer? Okay. So it's going to be a variant something like this. I get a genetic variant. It actually turns out that it impacts partly on more pleasurable effects from nicotine, but also reduces the negative effects. I don't know how many of you in the audience are smokers. Most of the time, you're kind of sick when you try that first cigarette. This makes it go down easier. Nicotine does not have such an adverse effect. We know that it increases the risk of nicotine dependence, which increases seeking cigarettes in the environment, which increases greater exposure to cigarette smoke, which then increases risk of lung carcinoma. So this is, in biomedicine, we call a gene that predisposes to cancer an oncogene. And this gene is an oncogene, but a quite strange one, because it acts through the volitional process. Instead of doing something about cell-cell contact, which is how cancer genes typically work, this is a gene that causes me to go out into the environment, actively seek out carcinogenic compounds, light them up, inhale them deeply into my lungs, thereby causing me to be at greater risk for cancer. This is a diagram that tries to introduce the concept that genes can impact on our disease phenotypes through traditional physiological pathways, what I and some others have considered inside the skin pathways, acting in brain, but also because my brain is effectively a transducing environment in which genes govern the influence. But my brain influences behavior that influence has an impact on the environment that then feeds back on susceptibility. So that in considering how genes cause disease, I have a traditional inside the skin pathway and an outside the skin pathway. And it is this that I think challenges our concepts of how volition and behavior impact on gene expression. Okay, now I want to turn this around and introduce a concept from moral philosophy called moral luck. Okay, I actually went to Wikipedia and gave you the Wikipedia introduction to this concept. Moral luck describes circumstances whereby a moral agent is assigned moral blame or praise for an action or its consequences, even though it is clear that said agent did not have full control over either the action or its consequences. This is related to Bernard Williams and Thomas Nagel, two very famous contemporary philosophers. So what's an example of moral good luck? I am in an argument with a friend. I am rageful at him. He insults me. I only see red. I run to the bedroom. I grab my loaded pistol. I run back. I pick it up at him. I pull the trigger in full intention to murder him. He turns, sees me, tries to run away, trips on the carpet and falls. My bullet passes through the plain glass window. There's a huge shattering of glass. I go, oh my God, what have I possibly done? And I come to my senses. Now that is an example where I fully had the intention to kill the son of a bitch, right? But luck intervened and I didn't kill him. Now with this, what is so interesting about this concept of moral luck is how it captures so clearly how we are on the cusp of a intentional deontological ethics. So my intentions were to kill him. Why all of a sudden am I less morally culpable because he happens to trip? Well, I mean, you lawyers talk about those things. In an intentionalist ethical system, there's a big difference because the outcome was different. Story two, moral bad luck, is he didn't trip, I shot him and I murdered him. Intentions were the same. Our moral intuitions, certainly mine, waver back and forth between these two perspectives about the blameworthiness of the person. Is the person who was lucky because the guy tripped when he fired the gun really less blameworthy? How do I translate into what I'm trying to do today? Well, my sense is that if you try to use a drug, you go ahead and drink heavily, you use cocaine, your volitional behavior is very much like pulling that trigger. And it has one possibility, which is that you have a low-risk genotype, so you have good moral luck. And that means you can use those drugs successfully and recreationally, and you have a good outcome. Does that mean you're morally less or more blameworthy? Well, I think that's not entirely clear. How is that different from the person who decides to use cocaine at the party but has a high-risk genotype who then, that initial drug use, leads down a path to drug dependence and poor moral outcome? So again, in our standard deontological approach, the intentions of both of those individuals, I want to get high on drugs, is identical. So you may ponder, how many in the audience here have gotten really drunk for a couple of days in a row? How many have tried cocaine but were able to stop after a short binge? Used amphetamines to study for an exam but didn't get hooked? Are you like the person who shoots to kill but the person slips because you have a set of low-risk genes? Do you deserve credit for this? How are you ethically different from the person with bad luck? So here, your volition is allowing your genes for risk to manifest themselves. But the typical problem is that before you use the drug, you don't know what the effect will be. So this is, I guess, what you'd say one way of framing the idea about how you play with fire when you use drugs without knowing your level of risk. So now let me take the next step. You grow up in a family with alcohol dependence. You see your father hitting on your mother. You see him stealing the money that's supposed to pay for the light bills. You grow up hating alcohol and its effects. But you also know that you have a high risk for alcohol dependence. What can you do that might impact on the expression of your genetic risk for alcohol dependence? Well, you can tell yourself, I'm never going to drink alcohol. It is, in fact, a well-known research phenomenon that the rates of teetotalers, those who are lifetime abstainers from alcohol, are increased in the families of alcoholics, as also are the rates of alcoholism. So you have the children going to two extremes. So I want you to think back about how potentially related these two worlds are, a gene mechanism on the one hand and volition on the other. That is that you, growing up in the family, have a potential decision to make through sufficient volition that you can turn to your alcohol risk genes and metaphorically say, you are never going to ruin my life. You're not going to have a chance for you to do to me what you did to my father. So a clear example of our volition being able to impact on our gene expression. So this is the way I sort of frame this volitional behavior. Do not use drugs with high-risk genotype. You have a good outcome. Now, if you happen to use that and you didn't inherit the high-risk alcohol genes from your dad, that good or bad luck, maybe you could have enjoyed drinking alcohol in a recreational way, but you missed some pleasurable effects. So the last step in this story, are we only able to influence penetrance of our own genes? So remember, my argument here is that for certain risk genes, we can volitionally impact on the probability of those genes being manifest. And the answer is no. There is, and I will speak colloquially here, but then show you some research evidence. Part of parenting is influencing the heritability of your children's traits. I think it is, in fact, common sense that part of what good parenting involves is increasing the penetrance of genes for positive traits. So if you have a child with musical ability, what does a good parent do? You go get your kids good lessons. You give them music studies. You send them to music camp. What, in fact, are you doing? You are actually allowing those genes for musical ability to have as rich a possible environment to manifest. You're trying to increase the penetrance of those genes. Maybe your son is a new Mozart. That'd be your goal. A child with math skills, what do? You make sure you go to a school district that has calculus in high school. You get him tutors. Again, the example is that you as a parent are really trying to influence the probability of a certain set of genes that you consider to have desirable effects to manifest themselves in your child. What about the reverse? So you have a mildly ADHD child, somewhat impulsive, poor judgment, sometimes does things that make you see red as a parent, right? Slaps their little sister, throws a glass against the door, you know, kicks in the glass frame on your door. Kids do that. It's been well studied. The so-called classic model of authoritative parenting. You encourage autonomy. You set clear limits. When limits are passed, it's an absolutely predictable effect. You go to your room. You lose your allowance. The kid knows what to expect. How well do parents like this impact on mild ADHD kids? And the answer is generally that has a favorable effect. The chance that the child will begin to internalize controls, and that's part of how you successfully parent. What are you doing? You're trying to turn down the genetic risks in the kids for that impulsivity. You're trying to cushion, to try to give the child some of your ego strength so they can stop and learn and overcome their inherent impulsivity. The other kind of pattern is initially authoritarian parenting, very demanding. The kid keeps acting out. You just go, the hell with you. Go out, run. I don't care. The kid comes back in, does something, bam, you know, right across the face, rapid anger. What happens to ADHD-like kids who are parented like that? In fact, you're being a hothouse for those genes. The kid is learning that parents are unpredictable, that by being more and more difficult, you reward his behavior by giving up. So instead of reducing the heritability, you're actually allowing those genes to manifest. You're really giving lots of water and sunshine to those ADHD impulsivity genes. Now, let me show you some research here. This is the particular article. I think it's not. I'm just going to skip directly to the key slide here. So this result is with an adoption study. This was done by Janae Niederheiser, who's done a series of studies here trying to put the intuitions that I just described to you on a firm empirical base. What we have on this axis is the quality of the mother's responsiveness to 9-month-old children. So these are really the infants, not even quite toddlers yet. How well does a mother respond when the child is upset? Is the mother successful at comforting? Is the mother providing a secure base for this infant? What we have here are the biological risk to that child, the genes that that child carries for difficult temperamental interactions as a result of whether the birth mother, the mother who gave the child up for adoption but did not see the child after birth, themselves did not have a high risk, which is the dotted line, which I won't concentrate on, versus those that had had major depression, and thus that was a child who was prone to experiencing negative temperaments, was easily irritable and fussy. What do you see the adoptive mother doing? If the adoptive mother provides very responsive good parenting, the fussiness of that child is actually lower than what is seen for a child who's not at genetic risk. On the other hand, if that adoptive mother is providing poorly responsive parenting, then the genes for that child, its fussiness, even as a young toddler, become manifest. So she's shown a series of studies like this. One other that I didn't take the data slide was showing the impact on disharmony in the home and fights between the parent and the child. You have, you know, when, and this was when the adopted children were into the terrible twos, the time when the kid is learning to say no, is beginning to defy parental authority. And what she showed is that in families, adoptive families that were moderately dysfunctional, the adoptive parents had psychiatric illness, there was some major romantic discord between the parents and fights, the correlation between the emotional problems in the biological mother and problems in the family was quite strong. On the other hand, when the families were intact, parents were healthy, were getting along and providing good parenting, the correlation went to zero. So what that meant was good parenting blocked out the effects of the irritable genotype of that child that inherited from the mother. So my last bit of data, and I'm getting toward the end now, is to show you a different kind around the concept of malleability. So part of what I've been trying to convey is that current research about the nature of gene action shows us that we are to a substantial extent responsible for our own individual development in the choices that we make that can impact on which of our genes, both of ourselves and of our children, are manifest. And I want to show you one other example from a very recent research project that demonstrates the degree to which we shape ourselves by our own experiences. The question here is, what influences our background moods? We know for a long time that individuals differ in their propensity to experience negative affect. Mostly we call that anxiety or depression. Some individuals are characterized by a very easygoing temperament, rarely are upset, rarely have difficulty with high levels of emotionality. Other individuals, on the other hand, are generally more tightly strung. Fewer adversities are necessary for them to demonstrate anxiety or depression. This goes by the terms of either neuroticism or emotional instability. What causes us as adults to be individually different from one another? What causes us to be generally the kind of person who is very level and easily, very easygoing in their approaches, and others that are more vulnerable and easily anxious? The most common theory is that of a genetic set point. Genes basically modulate where we are, an environmental perturbation will come, and we'll come back to it. That is illustrated on the next slide. No, two slides here. So the idea is that time is occurring, and I have something bad happen to me. I get into a fight with my supervisor, my spouse, I get a bad grade on an exam, I get upset, but given me a few days, I come back to baseline. And over time, this happens repeatedly. The question that I wanted to ask is, maybe there's a somewhat different pattern. We know that there are rare, long-term, highly traumatic emotional events. The two best studied in the literature is childhood sexual abuse and bad trauma in the military, that those severe traumatic events can impact on your risk for anxiety or depression years later. It is as if you are permanently shaped by those kinds of bad traumas, that your propensity for anxiety and depression is permanently altered. Would we see in more normal populations a pattern whereby if a negative thing happened to you, your anxiety would rise, but you wouldn't quite come back to baseline? It's sort of what we sometimes describe in our group as a ratchet model, in which there is some kind of cumulative effect, as if there is a memory, and you carry with yourself some of the impact of your environmental and emotional experience. Now, the way we attempted to look at this was, this is a kind of a diagram of our hypotheses. We studied identical twins so that we were controlling for the fact that they entered life with the same rearing environment in childhood and the same genetic risks, and would we expect that the differences over time were quite stable? So going back, if this model occurs And all that happens is that we get perturbed from our emotions and we return back to baseline over time. The prediction is that the similarity in identical twins, there's nothing cumulative going on here that'll be stable across the life course. On the other hand, if this is the pattern, and one of the twins has more of an emotional life experience than the other, what you expect to see is a steady differentiation. Twins will become increasingly different as they age because the environmental experiences they have from the environment they've created will lay down in them an impact on their emotional mood states. These are the results. This is 9 different sets of identical twin pairs from the Netherlands, several studies in Sweden, Australia, and our studies in the United States. And this is the pattern over years. So the twin pairs differed dramatically in ages. We were able to study twins who were in their teenage years, in their middle adult years, and 2 samples in old age. And what we saw was that the differences between the identical twins increased substantially over age. It was as if they grew apart. What does that mean? It means the genetic set point theory is not correct, and that we carry with us the long-term sequelae of our emotional experiences in our basic emotional constitution. So we are, I mean, when I was growing up, we used to talk about, this was the 1960s in the health food era, you are what you eat. Okay? What this suggests is that once we reach ages of middle adulthood, we are to a substantial extent what we have experienced. That the way we process regard the world around us, the moods that we carry forward, in part is the cumulative effect of the experiences that we have had. So a key part of my point today is to show you how active a role we play in the creation of ourselves. Okay. So I want to get 2 important caveats before I wrap up. By no means do I seek to imply that some gene action on behavior occur by unconscious biological processes where volition plays no role. So there are a number of examples like this in psychiatric disorders. So clearly genes act in traditional unconscious pathways. We know that. And that's the topic for another talk. I also don't mean to imply that volition is a simple switch-like phenomena that you do or don't have. Some of my examples involved addictions, and we understand that addictions compromise our volitional elements, but that too is another complex topic. So let me then try to sum up. I started by showing you from current research findings how complex pathways are from genes to behavior. Then I turned to the subject of the association between volition and gene action. We started with this pathway as the sole means by which genes influence behavior. The standard approach, genes, unconscious physiological processes produce behavior. We then introduced this new pathway for pure deviance and smoking to lung cancer, where between genes and the outcoming behavior involve conscious human beings making decisions. In this case, decisions whom to associate with in their social life, or decisions whether to go out and to smoke cigarettes. I then flip this problem around to see it in the context of moral luck, where we describe the relationship between volition and genetic penetrance, where volitional behavior causes us to use drugs with low-risk genotypes when we're morally lucky or when we're morally unlucky. I then examined lifetime alcohol abstention as an example of volitional control of gene penetrance. I then showed you that parents control gene expression in their children. I didn't comment about husbands and wives, but I would predict that any of you that have been married for a time period realize the same mechanisms occur there. And then I turned from the impact we have on our genes to the ways in which our environment can shape us. So I began with these 2 models of our world, atoms bouncing in the void, and conscious volitional agents. I hope that I've shown you that by using modern research results and not relying entirely on armchair philosophy, that we can show that in these remarkable human organisms, these 2 worlds are really intertwined, and that we actively collaborate with our own genes and our own environments in forming ourselves. Thank you.